This presentation has been previously broadcast.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hello and welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Just a word here about the traditional Latin Mass. I know many of you who listen are at least familiar with it, and some of you are devotees of it. I am. I love the traditional Latin Mass. And Catholic World Report has a story out this past weekend, which will be linked to on the show Twitter feed, which you can get to by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Traditional Latin Mass advocates appeal to the Pope to protect Summorum Pontificum. You may say, what? Summorum Pontificum? What's that? Summorum Pontificum was a motu proprio, or by his own will or his own accord, that was issued by Pope Benedict XVI, in which he really pushed hard the message that the traditional Latin Mass is for everybody who wants it, and priests are free to celebrate it. The faithful are able to request it. It can't be squelched. Bishops can't say no, that kind of thing. So this came out in 2007. It was an apostolic letter from Pope Benedict XVI. So here's the article from Catholic World Report. A federation that advocates for the traditional Latin Mass has appealed to Pope Francis to protect it from those, quote, within the church, including some bishops, who would like to see the extraordinary form of the Roman Rite explicitly suppressed. And to sort of paraphrase what I just said a minute ago, in 2007, the apostolic letter Summorum Pontificum recognized the vitality of the traditional liturgy, the freedom of priests to celebrate it, and of the faithful to request it. This has led to an ongoing increase in the number of celebrations of the ancient Latin Mass and of its spiritual fruits. The statement came in the form of an advertisement published on July 4th in the left-leaning Italian daily newspaper La Repubblica. It was signed by Felipe Alanis Suarez, the president of the International Federation Una Voce. Now, Una Voce is a phrase. It means one voice, with one voice, in other words. The organization reportedly conducted a survey of Catholics in 364 dioceses in 52 countries on the implementation of Summorum Pontificum. The survey, according to the statement, found that, quote, the ancient Latin Mass is deeply appreciated by groups of faithful of all ages, especially families with children, and that in many areas, the increased availability of this Mass has favored the normalization of relations between the faithful attached to it and their bishops. Una Voce was founded in 1967. It is not related to the movement started by Marcel Lefebvre, that's the SSPX, so it's not related to them, and its principal aims are, quote, to ensure that the traditional Roman rite of the church is maintained in the church as one of the forms of liturgical celebration, and to safeguard and promote the use of Latin, Gregorian chant, sacred polyphony, and all the sacred, artistic, literary, and musical traditions of the Roman Church in all their beauty and integrity. Now, I'm going to pause there. Lest anybody wonder about this, you may say, well, Vatican II changed all that. Well, check it out. Read the document, Sacrosanctum Concilium. That's the Vatican II document, on the reform of the liturgy, and it points out, among other things, that Gregorian chant is to be given pride of place. In other words, the first go-to option, your default option at the parish level, according to the Second Vatican Council, as far as liturgical music is concerned, is Gregorian chant. Now, that may be true in some parishes, but widely it's not true. And that's an example of where even some of the things that the council itself called for have been ignored in favor of aberrations and novelties and things like that. In the July 4th statement, Una Voce wrote that, quote, contrary to the previous policy of the Holy See, there are still people within the church, including some bishops, who would like to see the extraordinary form of the Roman Rite, that is the traditional Latin Mass, explicitly suppressed or subject to further restrictions. The statement argues, quoting the words from Pope Francis, that, quote, the growth of interest in the traditional liturgy is not due to nostalgia for a time we do not remember or a desire for rigidity. It is rather a matter of opening ourselves to the value of something that for most of us is new and inspires hope. Pope Francis has characterized the ancient liturgy in terms of, quote, a sense of adoration. We can also apply his words to it, a living history that welcomes us and pushes us forward. Una Voce also wrote, we only wish to be part of that great orchestra of the unity and variety, which, as Pope Francis said in a general audience in 2013, reflects the true Catholicity of the Church. The Apostolic Letter Summorum Pontificum continues to transform the conflicts of the past into harmony. Long may it continue to do so. And I agree 100%. So I'll just leave it at this. FYI, there have long been, this in itself is nothing new, but there have long been people and to some extent organizations in the church who would love nothing more than to dance on the grave of the traditional Latin Mass, to have it dead and buried and gone forever. They don't want to see people going to the traditional Latin Mass. They're opposed to it, and they have their reasons, none of which are good, if you ask me. But history has shown, and I think Pope Benedict should be thanked, and we should say prayers of gratitude to him, or not to him, obviously, to God for the Apostolic Letter Summorum Pontificum, because he reminded everybody, including the bishops, that this is something that cannot be taken away from the people, that we have a right to this if that's something that you want. So priests have the right to celebrate it. You have the right to attend the traditional Mass if you wish. Always in union with your bishop, of course. That goes without saying. But be aware that there are people who are trying to squelch this. They would like to see it go away. And so I, for one, am very happy that Una Voce sent this appeal just to remind everybody that this is something that's part of the patrimony of the church, and it deserves the respect that, the respect that it deserves, I'll put it that way. And we'll post a link to this. Cyrus will post a link to this, and you can access the links to everything that we post on the show Twitter feed by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Let's go to Patricia in British Columbia. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question or my concern is regarding the SXPX. Mm-hmm. I believe that they're not in communion with the Holy See, but one would still be able to attend, say, a funeral mass for someone in their church, but we are not to receive communion. Is that a fair summation mm-hmm. of a fair understanding of?
Mm-hmm. It is not, no. Let me begin by saying this, because I want to make sure that my perspective on this is clear. I myself have never been associated with the SSPX. In fact, I've publicly been critical of the SSPX, the Society of St. Pius X, because I'm convinced that what they did, although some of the motives that Archbishop Lefebvre had and his sensibilities and his goals and things, I am sympathetic to those things. And so it's one of those strange situations where, on the one hand, I find a great kind of solidarity with some of these aims, but the way it was done, I think, was entirely wrong. And it was the ordination, or the consecration, I should say, of the four men who Archbishop Lefebvre consecrated as bishops. This is in 1988. And it was against the express wishes of Pope John Paul II, who decreed that they had excommunicated themselves by doing this. And the SSPX historically, certainly since that time, has been in not only a state of limbo, so to speak, with regard to its relationship with the church, but also the atmosphere within the SSPX. And I know this only from the things that I've read in articles and things that they produce online in books and such, but also a number of people that I've met over the years and have talked to around the country who are adherents of the SSPX and have a very hostile attitude toward the rest of the church. And I think maybe more than anything else would be that attitude of hostility and a kind of supercilious dismissal of all those Catholics who are not members of the SSPX. I find that very problematic, to say the least. So I'm putting this up front to say, I'm not only not an adherent of the SSPX, I strongly oppose the way they have gone about doing what they're doing, even though I'm sympathetic to many of their goals, which I I hope that that makes it clear. So what about going to their masses? What about going to their priest, say, for confession, for example? The best way I can explain this to you in a nutshell is to say that Father John Zulsdorf, he goes by the handle Father Z, you may have seen or heard of him on online, Patricia, he has written a wonderful and I think very helpful article that answers these questions. It's called What is the Truth About the SSPX? And he publishes back in April of 2020, excuse me. And I'm going to retweet that, so you'll find it at the very top of my Twitter feed. And at the next break, I'll have that up there for you. And what he says is essentially this. He says it is true that they are in a state that is, to put it one way, it's irregular. So they're not out of the church. They're not excommunicated. The excommunications for the bishops were lifted. Their masses are celebrated in the Roman Rite. So it is an approved rite of the church. So it is a valid mass. And so he says, in answer to the question, is it sinful to go to an SSPX mass? His answer is, it depends on why you're going there. He says, frankly, yes, it would be sinful to go to their masses out of sheer desire to hurt local parishes or priests, or because you hate the local bishop or the pope or some aspect of the church, blah, blah, blah. Frankly, yes, he says, it would be sinful to attend a parish where there are liturgical abuses that you happen to know are abuses, but you like those abuses and you don't really care about authority. And then he says, no, frankly, it is not sinful to attend an SSPX mass if you are seeking sound liturgy and preaching and other good people who desire the same question. So he's dealing on these levels with the laicity. Is it lawful for you to do this? And this is where I think we have to be really careful so that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, as the saying goes. So I would refer you to read this article. It's well worth your time to do so. And the bottom line that Father Z takes is that under various circumstances that he spells out, it would be permissible to do this, even according to the church herself, and pointing out that Pope Francis, for his part, had given faculties to the SSPX priest to hear confessions validly. And that faculty has not been withdrawn. So it is an odd situation that we find ourselves in. And I would just say Father Z says it far better and far more comprehensively than I ever could. So I'll refer you to his article. And you'll find it on my Twitter feed here in just a few minutes. I hope that's helpful to you. Thank you, Patricia. Let's go now to Rod in Arcata. Is it Arcata or Arcata, California? Rod. Maybe Rod's not ready. We'll come back to Rod. Let's go to Deb now in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Deb.
Hi, Patrick. My question for you today is about the collect. My husband and I were having our prayer time, and we read the entrance antiphon and the collect and then go on to the scriptural readings. But as I was ending the collect, it says, who lives and reigns with you in the unity of the Holy Spirit, God forever and ever. Mm-hmm. I thought it said one God forever and ever. Has there been a change to that, or am I just mistaken?
No, you're correct. There was a change. It was removed, one God forever and ever. And the reason is because it doesn't, the phrase one God does not appear in the original Latin. So it's a restoration of the authentic Latin that underlies the translation.
Okay, well, very good. I just noticed it, and I pray it that way forever, and I thought, whoa, there's a change here. So thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, you're right. By the way, I think the more common or the more traditional pronunciation is the collect of the Mass.
Oh, okay, sorry. Okay.
No. Believe me, I'm not saying you did anything wrong. I'm just saying that if you ever hear somebody say the collect of the Mass, they're referring to the same thing that you are. FYI,
okay.
That's all.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Deb. Nice to talk to you. And let's see if we can get back to Rod. Rod in California, are you there?
Yes, I am.
It's okay, Arcata. Welcome. Arcata, there we go. Okay.
So I am wondering, during the 6 days of creation, were they six literal days, six 24-hour days? I'm leaning towards that because in Genesis it says evening and morning the first day. Mm-hmm. Evening and morning the second day, and evening, morning all the way through the sixth day. So it sounds like it's a 24-hour period, unless I'm missing something here.
Well, it's certainly described as a 24-hour period, that's for sure. So it's presented to us in the form of seven sidereal days, 24-hour days. The question really is that the intended meaning in a literal sense? And I would say that the church proposes no. Now, historically, certainly the church fathers and the great doctors of the church over the centuries, without the benefit of modern science, they held to a strictly literal interpretation, many of them, if not most of them. And so the preponderance of Catholic opinion on this topic over the centuries would have been that this is literal. But as science has begun to shed more light on the way in which the universe was formed and how long it would take to do various things, the church recognizes that there's no danger to us or no danger to the faith to take into account the things that science can tell us about God's revelation in the physical realm. And so the church certainly does not tell us that we must believe that this account is understood literally. It is harmonious with what science has shown us, that it could have taken eons of time, billions of years, for example, for the elements to form and to form into planets and such. But none of that would in any way diminish the fact that God did all of this, that God created the cosmos and everything in it directly and indirectly. He caused it. So preserving the traditional doctrine of Adam and Eve as our first parents, preserving the fact that God created all things out of nothing, that's all part of Catholic teaching, but it's harmonious with the scientific discoveries about how long these processes took. Now, there's a book, it's a short little book, but I think it's very helpful. When I first read it, it was really illuminating for me. It's called In the Beginning, A Catholic Understanding of the Story of Creation and the Fall. Now, this is by none other than then Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who became Pope Benedict XVI. So this is a theological reflection upon Scripture and the teachings of the church, and he gets right into the very issue of what does it mean in Genesis that God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. So if you're looking for, I would argue, a magisterial comment on the topic, I would go there first and let that sort of elucidate some of the things that I just talked about. He's far better at it than I am.
Okay. Okay, appreciate it. Thank you.
You got it, Rod. Thank you. And we'll get a link to this book so that you can check it out for yourself. That'll be on the show Twitter feed, and the show Twitter feed is embedded on the show page, which is relevantradio.com, and you'll be able to find it there momentarily. I think we should take a break, and we'll come back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show, including your phone calls, right after this. Please stay right there. I'll be right back. The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we are back. We're going to go back to the phones here in just a second. FYI, if you are lactose intolerant or know somebody who is, there's hope on the horizon. Researchers in Russia, this is according to the Daily Mail, have announced that they produced their first viable cloned cow whose genes have been edited to make hypoallergenic milk. You're saying, what does that mean? Okay, so the calf, 140 pounds, born in April of 2020. For her first year, she was kept in a separate enclosure with her mother. Now at 14 months, she's nearly up to half a ton, appears healthy with a normal reproductive cycle. Since May, she's been in the daily pasture with the other cows of the institute. But what makes this one different from all the other cows is that they successfully altered her genes to not produce the protein that makes you lactose intolerant. They worked with colleagues at another institute, this in Moscow, to knock out the genes responsible for the beta-lactoglobulin, the protein that causes lactose malabsorption, often called lactose intolerance in humans. The researchers, they removed the two genes representing the beta-lactoglobulin in the bovine genome. They managed to clone the calf using somatic cell nuclear transfer with the nucleus from a regular cell of a donor transferred into an egg with its nucleus removed. The resulting embryo was then implanted into the uterus of a cow and carried to term. While genetically modified mice are fairly common phenomena, modifying other species is exponentially harder due to the higher costs and difficulties in husbandry, etc. Thus, a methodology leading to cattle with hypoallergenic milk is not only a necessity for agriculture of the future, but also a cool project, according to one of the researchers. Nearly 70% of the world's population has some form of lactose malabsorption, according to the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, making it difficult for people to digest milk and other dairy products derived from cattle. So if this works, maybe you won't have to worry about it, because maybe you'll be able to drink milk and it won't bother your stomach. Wouldn't that be cool? 888-914-9149. Let's go to Jerry in Hermitage, Pennsylvania. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning, Patrick. You were talking earlier about Elvis Presley having Jewish roots.
Right.
And I read somewhere recently that people of the Iberian Peninsula, that's Spain and Portugal, that's something like 75% of them have Jewish DNA. And I know Spanish background.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have DNA results or anything like that, but I'm almost certainly in that group because when the Jews were expelled from Spain in 1493 by King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, they were expelled unless they converted. Some decided that they would convert. And what's interesting is that one of the signs that somebody may be related all those centuries ago to those Jews is the surname. So in my case, the surname Madrid, that's not a Spanish name. So, you know, all the Spanish folk who had lived there for centuries, they would have names that, you know, Garcia, Mendoza, etc. Well, to take the name of a city like Valencia or Madrid, that was usually what the Jews who would convert would do, because they didn't have, in many cases, those family names. So the fact that my last name is Madrid, going all the way back on that side of the family anyway, is one of those indications. Now, I noticed something interesting, Jerry, some years ago, that the government of Spain had announced that it would grant citizenship for people who could demonstrate an ethnic connection to the Jews. And, I mean, I'm Catholic. My family's Catholic. We've been Catholic for centuries, as far as I'm aware. But we probably do have some lineage that goes back to the Jews of old in Spain. And so I actually wrote a letter to the Spanish government. It was actually to the consulate here, somewhere here in the U.S., asking if this was the case. And they got back to me and they said, yeah, well, we're working on that program. We haven't rolled it out yet. So just wait and see what happens. But among the names that were given, Madrid was one of them. And they said, if you can establish a connection here that you're legally and ethnically part of this, then you would be a candidate to receive Spanish citizenship. And that's where I left it. And it's been years since that came up. But to answer your question, yeah, it is an interesting background to that.
Not only that, but even the people of Latin America, South America, and Central America, Mexico, they say 33% of them may have Jewish roots.
Yeah, isn't it cool?
Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Jerry. Pope Pius XI, in his encyclical Against the Nazis in Germany, was actually ghostwritten by Eugenio Pacelli, who became Pope Pius XII upon Pius XI's death. But in German, the encyclical, it was written in German, is Mit brennender Sorge, with anxious heart, I believe it's translated. In that encyclical, Pope Pius XI, he says that all Christians are spiritual Semites, meaning even if you don't have a drop of blood from any ethnic connection with Judaism, and yes, I know there are different branches of Judaism, Sephardic and Ashkenazi, and I'm familiar with those. But the point is, he said that all Christians, by virtue of being baptized into Jesus Christ are spiritual Semites, and we have Abraham as our common father. So lest anybody find themselves lapsing into or tending toward a kind of anti-Semitism, God forbid, just remember that if you're a baptized Christian, the Pope himself has said that you yourself are a spiritual Semite, underscoring the solidarity that we have, at least in terms of the heritage that comes to us from Judaism. 888-914-9149. We'll go now to Gerard in Milwaukee. Good morning, Gerard.
Hey, Patrick. I've got kind of a softball question for you today.
Okay.
In talking about the Latin Mass earlier in the morning on your program, mm-hmm. and probably some old nun in grade school told me this, but I don't remember. Why is the Latin Mass entirely Latin, or the liturgy entirely in Latin, with the exception of the Kyrie eleison? That's Greek.
Right.
And the only thing I can see in the entire Latin Mass or the liturgy, as far back as I've looked, is that section in Greek. Why is that?
Yeah. It's an artifact that is held over from the earlier Greek liturgies that predated those in Latin. Now, the Latin liturgy took root very quickly because, after all, Saints Peter and Paul went to Rome, and Saint Peter was there for about 25 years. So the Latin version of the Mass, which was originally celebrated in, let's say, Aramaic or Hebrew, quickly began to be celebrated in Greek, and then shortly after that in Latin. So as I understand the pedigree of that prayer, it was retained as a way to preserve that link with the Greek origins of the church.
Okay. And you know, I remember the old gals always telling us that Satan hates Latin. So that's why I still enjoy going to a Latin Mass.
Yeah, that's, I do too. I love the traditional Latin Mass. My wife and I don't attend a Latin Mass parish, but I try to go to the Latin Mass whenever the opportunity comes up. But you're right that the Kyrie eleison is in Greek. And there are other languages present too. So we see, for example, Amen, which is Hebrew, and Hosanna, Hebrew, Alleluia, Hebrew. So the Mass, even the traditional Latin Mass, is comprised not just of Latin, but also the Kyrie in Greek and those other words in Latin. I'm sorry, in Hebrew. So
yeah,
it is a beautiful connection to the past.
Great. Thanks for answering.
Thank you, Gerard. I always appreciate softball questions. Don't always get them, but I appreciate them. Let's go to Michelle now in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Patrick. I have a question for you regarding the commandment to honor thy father and thy mother, which
yeah.
I take very seriously. And the question that I have for you is that I'm right now in the middle of some of my parents' healthcare crises, and I don't think they're making good decisions.
Okay.
And in making those poor decisions, they are also impacting my own family, my work stress, all of those things. And I want to be very careful that I'm honoring that commandment, but also honoring me and what my family needs at the same time. And I find those difficult waters to navigate, and I didn't know if you had any advice.
Well, as a matter of fact, I do. that commandment to honor your father and mother when we're young, of course, that includes obedience and service to our parents. And as we get older and they get older, it takes different forms. And one way of honoring your elderly parents, especially as they begin to lose many of their powers of intellect and memory and things, one way to honor them is to help guide them in ways that are not often easy, because people, when they get elderly, sometimes don't realize that they're losing their grip on some of those faculties. And maybe you've experienced that where, you know, it's difficult for them to, if you say, Dad, you can't drive anymore, and you're not dishonoring your father, but because of his age or his maybe impairment mentally, it's dangerous for him to drive, you're actually honoring your father by insisting that he not do something that maybe he doesn't understand, or he gets angry that you're saying that he should not do this, but it's in his best interest. In a counterintuitive way, you are actually honoring him by doing that. The trouble, it seems to me, is how to go about doing that without causing an uproar. You know, if your parents are resistant and defensive about some of the decisions that you would like to see them make or that you would like to make for them, how do you maintain that posture of looking out for their welfare and at the same time respect their wishes? That's tricky. And sometimes it's hard to know where that line is because, you know, we can't say with certitude exactly how forgetful or how, you know, impaired in some other way a parent might be. So you do the best you can. And I think that's the way to fulfill the commandment, not only the letter of the commandment, but the spirit of the commandment, is that God knows your heart and he realizes that you're seeking to do what's best for your parents and that they may not recognize that what you're doing is for their benefit. So as long as you're not being mean to them or heavy-handed or unnecessarily intrusive into their life, but you're doing prudent things in a prudent way, God sees that. And I think that's where at least I try to pursue this fulfillment of the commandment in a way that will honor my parents, but at the same time, you know, sometimes you have to push a little bit harder to get something done for their benefit, for their well-being. And I'm sure all of that rings true for you. I mean, I'm sure you're in the middle of that.
Yes, yes. And I really thank you very much for that piece of advice, because I think the key word that I'm taking from all of this is prudence and love, but understanding that sometimes you may need to step in, but yeah.
Yeah. And it can be messy,
so I just say
and
thanks.
Painful, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but God sees it, and that's the most important person who sees it.
That's the key, right?
Even
there,
in my struggle. Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome,
it.
Michelle. God bless you, and as things proceed, I hope that this becomes easier and easier for you. 888-914-9149. Now over to Covina, California to talk to James. Hi, James.
Hi, Patrick. Good morning. Patrick, my question is on faith, and here's my question. I'm going to quote two scriptures, well, three if I have time, but here's the first scriptures in Romans. I'll paraphrase it. You know, it says that, why do you hope for something you already have? And then when I read Hebrews 11, it says that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. So my question is this. When you pray for something, whether it's healing or whatever problem you may have, the fact that you don't have it, that valley in between is your faith. Because in Romans, it's, you know, as you say, it says that why would you pray for something you already have? So if I'm praying for something, the fact that I don't have it yet is my faith. And the fact that I don't have it, I should become joyful in anticipation of the manifestation of what I expect. And then that leads me to the third verse in Hebrews 11:13 that says, some died without receiving the promise, and they died in faith. So let's say I'm praying for a loved one, like my mom had died and several years ago, and I was praying. So the fact that she died, I don't want to say this. The fact that she died or anybody died doesn't mean that God didn't answer your prayer. It just means that maybe, you know, I don't know, in the resurrection, whatever, that person may be healed, or the fact that I may not receive what I want. And let's say I'm sick and I pray and I die.
Yeah.
Well, doesn't mean God didn't hear your prayer. The fact that you're waiting for that manifestation may not be now. It may be later on. Does that make sense what I'm saying? That's what I'm basically asking. That
I think
faith
so.
Is that waiting period.
Yeah, I think so. So let's unravel that. First of all, I think you're referring to Romans chapter 8, verse 24 and 25, if I had to guess, which says, for in this hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. So does that get, is that the first passage you're thinking of?
Yes, that's it.
Okay. So this is referring to hope, strictly speaking, but it can't be divorced from faith, because as you know, faith is that the assurance or the belief in the promise of something that you haven't received yet. I mean, you don't have it yet, but you have faith. So take eternal life. We have faith in God that he will be true to his promises. Now we hope in the resurrection, but that too is based upon something that we don't have yet. So this being the case, in looking at Hebrews chapter 11, keep in mind that Hebrews chapter 11 is a kind of a recounting of the Hall of Fame, as you might think of it, of Old Testament saints who, through their exploits, they showed their faith in God. And when it says that they didn't receive the promise that they were waiting for in faith, it's referring to they didn't live to see the advent of the Messiah. They didn't live to see Jesus, who was promised to them, actually come forth as the Messiah. We do see that in Luke's gospel, where Jesus is presented in the temple by his parents, and Simeon the prophet says, "Nunc dimittis, Domine, now, Lord, you may dismiss your servant, because I have seen, and he's right here in my arms, the promise of salvation that you have gained to our forefathers, and now I have lived to see it." And so Simeon would be an example of finally seeing the thing that you had been hoping for and longing for and having faith in all those years. So with that being the case, point out the conundrum, because I'm not sure what the difficulty is here or what the sticking point is for you.
Not a conundrum. I was just saying that when you pray for something and we don't see it yet, that waiting period that we're hoping for to happen, mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, heal me or get a job or having a trial or whatever, the fact that we don't receive it, that shouldn't discourage us. That should say, hey, that's faith. Otherwise, in other words, I guess I'm saying that if you don't have problems in life, then why exercise faith? What would be the need for faith if you have everything you want, right?
It depends on what you have faith in. So, I mean, if your faith is in eternal life, you don't have that yet in this life. You haven't laid hold of it. If your faith is in a new car every year, well, that's a mundane kind of thing. I guess it would depend on what you are hoping for, what you're having faith in. Keep in mind, James, and I know you know this, but it's worth remembering that in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus asked the Father, he prayed, "Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me, but not my will, but thine be done." So the thing that Jesus was praying for, his intention, was not granted to him. And he was perfectly in line with the will of the Father, obviously. But even there, we see an example of where Jesus himself prayed for something and he did not get it. Does that play into the point that you're making?
Yes. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yes. Yes. All right. Well, that makes sense, Patrick. I appreciate it. And I have one more question to ask you. Do you have time? Just one quick question.
I'm afraid I don't, just because the clock is ticking and I've got a ton of people waiting to get on the air. So how about this, James? Give me a call back another day and we'll take up your next question. Thank you. We'll go to Ann now in Las Vegas. Hi, Ann.
Hey, Patrick.
I'm just responding. You said hello and I said hello back.
Oh, you're responding. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm okay. Sorry. There was a pause there. I've called you a few times. Anyway, I just wanted to get your thoughts, and I'm not sure. You might not. It's still kind of new, but the stuff that's going on up in Canada right now, mm-hmm. With these children being found, and I haven't listened to relevant radio in a couple of weeks, and my kids get out of school on summer break. I don't get to listen to the radio as much, but I wasn't sure if anybody on relevant radio has addressed it or talked about it, and I feel like all I'm seeing is just whatever articles come across my feed on Facebook about the children, the bodies being found up in Canada.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've talked, I wouldn't say extensively about it, but I have talked several times on this program about that very topic, recent weeks.
Yeah, and I haven't listened to you in a week or good week or so, but
tisk, tisk.
I'm a strong Catholic, not always have been, but I am now. And even through anything that was going on in the church that was negative, scandal or whatnot, I've always, plowed through, and I didn't pay any attention to it. And I, it was sad, but my faith stayed strong. But I'm feeling a little rocked by this certain scenario that's going on, and I don't want to say I'm questioning my faith, but if we were talking one school or one church, I wouldn't, I'd think, something really sad, and hopefully those people get help. But because we're talking about so many schools, so many churches, it's worrying me a little bit that there could have been that many corrupted individuals, I suppose.
All right.
And there were so many posts during that time. Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah, let me first jump in just because some people may not be aware of what you're referring to. Okay. And this is a story that's really blazing in Canada right now. Maybe not as many Americans are familiar with it. In essence, what has happened is that there were boarding schools that were owned and operated for the most part. Well, they were certainly owned, established by the Canadian government. And in some cases, they were administered by different religious groups, including Catholic religious orders. And the goal of these places was, among other things, to provide an education for Indigenous children, to teach them how to read and write and how to get productive training and various things. But the history of some of these schools, such as the one in Kamloops, which is the one that I think first burst onto the scene in the last month or two, was that they discovered some mass graves of children. So 215 children were found, the remains were found, rather, on the grounds of this residential school. Now, in the time since this story broke, and I've been trying to keep abreast of it as best I can, some of the places that were described as mass graves, it turns out that they were not mass graves where, like, bodies of children were dumped into them, but rather they were buried, and there's evidence of crosses that were placed on top of their individual graves. But the problem is that it appears as though the Catholic religious orders who were involved with this, that in some cases that they severely maybe mistreated these children. The question right now is, were any of these children either allowed to die or worse? Did that happen at the hands of some of these people? And I think the investigation that's underway will help to determine that. But the thing to remember is that, let's just say that the worst case scenario is true, and that not only in the case of the Kamloops graves in British Columbia, but the other places where this is happening, if it turns out that there were Catholic nuns and priests, and other Catholics for that matter, who were despicable in their actions toward these native children, then that is not something that we should deny or try to explain away or sweep under the rug or anything like that. It must be owned up to and apologized for, no question about it. And the problem is that right now, given the racial tensions that exist here in Canada and elsewhere, it's all the more volatile, it's all the more inflammatory, because you're dealing with white colonial, and the word colonial we can use in quotation marks here, people, and religious people at that, who were mistreating, it seems, Indigenous people whose skin wasn't white, whose skin was brown. So this story takes on a heightened sense of urgency and a heightened sense of drama, I guess, in the minds of many people today. So my advice would be, as these stories come out, let's first of all get the facts. Some of these alleged mass graves, it seems, were not mass graves in the wrong sense of the term, but they were places where these children were buried. Well, why were they buried? Why did they die? These are natural questions. So we should follow the evidence wherever it goes and own up to it. And if the Catholics who are involved, in fact, are shown to have done terrible things, then that's something that the church should certainly apologize for and learn from. And learn from. That's the key, it seems to me. That this does not call into question the truth of the Catholic faith. It does not in any way call into question the validity of the message of Jesus Christ, etc. But rather, it just shows that if, in fact, these terrible things happened the way we suspect that they did, that some Catholics, they go off the rails and they do bad things. And that's not cause for us to be shaken in our faith. I would encourage you, don't be shaken, Anne, in your faith, and don't let that prod you into thinking maybe you should leave, but rather see it as a cautionary tale. Here's what happens.
Yes, thank you.
When Catholics don't live up to the teachings of Jesus Christ. You see what I'm saying?
Helpful. I need a clarification. And I'm going to stay strong. It just disturbs me a little bit, I suppose.
It should. If it's as bad as it seems it might be, it should disturb you. It should disturb all of us. And it should be a cautionary tale for us to always strive to do better. Thanks, Anne. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
At the intersection of faith and culture, The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
We are back, and thank you for listening, as ever. The number is 888-914-9149. We don't have a lot of time left, but we'll make use of the time that we've got. Let's start with Stephen in Chicago. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Patrick. I have a question in regards to the Jewish faith.
Sure.
When I was 18 years old, I dated a girl, went to visit her in a hospital. She had a mental breakdown, and there was a roommate in the room who got up and left, and I just asked what happened to that girl. She said she was part of a Jewish satanic cult. They made her give birth to a baby and used it for sacrifice, and she flipped out. Later, I saw that girl appeared on Oprah, and which gave credibility to that story, and she said she helped girls escape Jewish satanic cults. And I wanted to ask you, because I basically am doing my research in history and so forth, is there a sect in Judaism that you know of that rules by demoralization? And again, this is not to be derogatory towards all Jewish people in general. It's a question for the sake of the truth.
Well, not only have I never heard of, you know, any bona fide evidence of that, I don't believe it. And who knows what this girl may have told you. I'm not questioning the veracity of what you're saying you experienced, but this seems to be part of that old blood libel notion that Jews practice, or some Jews anyway, practice satanic ceremonies, and they, you know, kill Christian infants and drink their blood and some such things. And I don't believe any of that stuff at all. So you mentioned that she was on Oprah. It would be very interesting, since the Oprah episodes are all cataloged. You can go back and locate which episode she was on and perhaps even watch it if it's available on video. So that, I think, would have made the headlines, don't you think? If a Jewish woman were to have appeared on Oprah, of all things, which is a widely watched television program, and made the claim that there were satanic Jewish sects that were, you know, having children for the purpose of killing them ritually, don't you think that would have made the headlines? I do.
You can Google, if you go on YouTube, if you put like Oprah Jewish satanic cult, the video's on there. I mean, she was on Oprah.
Well, okay. I haven't seen it. You know, I'm not saying that I've ever looked into whether or not she was on Oprah, but I would be very surprised, to say the least, if a Jewish girl made the claim on Oprah on national television that there were Jewish sects that were performing these outlandish sacrifices and that it didn't get any media attention. I mean, I would think that the ADF, or what is it, the ADL, the anti-discrimination,
yeah.
I mean, you'd think that they would be all over that. And I don't remember ever hearing anything like that before, at least not with regard to Oprah. So one thing for sure I've learned over the years, Stephen, there are a lot of things on the internet that aren't true. And I take everything with a grain of salt. And I would encourage you to do the same thing.
Okay,
definitely.
Thank
on this
you very
issue.
Much.
You're welcome. Thank you. All right. Let's go now to Laguna Niguel, California. I know that town very well, and talk to Kathleen. Hi, Kathleen. I used to play when I was in high school playing soccer at my school. We used to play Laguna Niguel High School.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Small world. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. You're welcome.
I'm really grateful for Relevant Radio and for you and Drew and Kale and Father Rocky and all of you at Relevant
Thank
Radio,
you.
What you do. I'm learning how to be Catholic.
Oh,
and thank you. So I have two questions that are burning. When you say to somebody, somebody's going through a hardship or whatever, and you say, I will pray for you. In the past, I would say, and Our Father and a Hail Mary, and then I would list people and what, and I have kind of a long list. I'm a mother, so I have a long list of my kids, my family, their friends.
We have about a minute,
and then people
Kathleen,
have hardship.
I just don't want you to get cut off.
So how is the right way to pray when you have a list of people?
You can
when
pray
you say,
for all of them.
For you.
Yeah, you can pray for all of them with, you say, Lord, here are my prayers. I pray for all the people I promised to pray for. That's something that I say every day. For all the people I promised to pray for, here's my prayer. So you can have a virtual intention to pray for each one of them, even if you don't mention them each by name. Maybe that's what you're asking.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. But also, like, start with the Our Father, start with
any way you
Hail
want.
Mary. Do you any offer you one want. Per person?
No, any
oh,
way
okay.
you want. So let's say that you say, I want to pray my rosary today for all those people I promised to pray for. And Lord, you remember them, even though I don't. And I'm praying for all of them right now. You can say formula prayers. It could be prayers from your heart or a combination. Anything like that's fine.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You.
I wish we had more time, Kathleen. Call me another time and we can dig deeper, okay? Well, thank you, and my thanks to all of you for listening. I'll be back with you again tomorrow, same Pat time, same Pat channel. Please pray for me. I'll pray for you. God bless you.